Our readings this morning come from the Gospel according to Luke, and the first reading is from chapter 16 and verse 19. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. He called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. Besides all this, between you and us, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us." He said, "Then, Father, I beg you to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them." He said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." And then we go backwards to Luke chapter 12 and verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then he told them a parable: the land of a rich man produced abundantly. And he thought to himself, "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich toward God." Amen. This morning, as you may have guessed, we're going to consider two stories from the Gospel according to Luke, which provide us with good examples of how Jesus brought a number of elements together in order to challenge his listeners and to make people think. His stories have a timeless quality about them, hence the telling of them even today. But a knowledge of his times and the way people understood things in his day are important to bear in mind. In the story of the rich man and Lazarus, the realities of wealth and poverty are immediately evoked or brought to mind as Jesus begins to tell the tale. And the first thing that strikes us is the stark contrast between the two men. We are told that there was a rich man. He dressed in the finest, most expensive clothing, and every day of his existence indulged in feasts. In other words, his life was one of great abundance. There was also a poor man. His name was Lazarus, which means "God helps." He was so poor and sick and covered in sores that the neighborhood dogs would lick his wounds. Lazarus longed for one thing: to satisfy his hunger with what he imagined fell from the table of the rich man. And he lay at the gate of the rich man's home. We could ask, would Jesus' hearers have identified with any of this? And the answer is yes. Although Jesus wasn't implying that all the rich were as extravagant and as callous as the rich man in the story, nor were all the poor people in a state like Lazarus. But by using the stark contrast and the opposite examples, Jesus was certainly raising the social problems of his time and his place. We are thus invited not only to consider the fate of individuals, but also the economic realities that played such an important part of people's lives. So what were the economic realities of Jesus' time? Well, much the same as we witness in our world today. Wealth and power were concentrated in the hands of a minority. The majority of people were peasants whose sole source of income was subsistence farming. And this meant that they had to produce enough to feed their families and any livestock they might have had. And on top of that, they would have had to produce enough to ensure social relationships, which were very important. And this included being able to provide hospitality when things like weddings and births and funerals took place. I know in the culture that I come from, when people have a wedding, an African wedding, it goes on for days. And the couple have to provide food and shelter and all those kinds of things. And often, the people don't have the money. On top of that, they had to pay tax to the landowner, and this was done either through labor or produce or money. And friends, these were the lucky ones. Most, some say up to 90% of the population were outcasts and beggars. They were the expendables. And what makes the contrast so great in the parable Jesus told is the fact that Lazarus lay right outside the gates of the rich man's home. This proximity, writes Stephen Wright, is Lazarus's particular tragedy and the rich man's particular judgment. And it's a contrast that continues even after the two of them had died. For we are told that when both men died, the rich man was afforded a burial, whilst Lazarus, by implication, was left without any burial at all. After their respective deaths, what we witness or hear in the parable are the standard pictures of the afterlife. The setting of Jesus' story continues to be the world of his hearers, both their world of belief and also their social environment. And as we can see, what we witness is a particularly Jewish take on the afterlife. One in which Father Abraham, the father of the nations, takes pride of place. And he's still known for the kind of hospitality that we witness in the Old Testament to God's messengers in Genesis chapter 18. The Jewishness of the story is ramped up even more when we get to verse 29. For there Abraham responds to the rich man in torment by telling him his brothers have Moses and the prophets to listen to, men who had encouraged, enjoined Israel to care for who? To care for the poor. Up until that point, we have no idea whether the rich man was a Jew or a Gentile. But the identity of Lazarus is in no doubt. As I said before, his name in Hebrew, Eliezer, means God helps. The point has been made when considering this parable, and this is important, that neither the rich man nor Lazarus did anything particularly evil. But perhaps this is the point, the part of the point that Jesus is making. The fact that nothing was done. Also, we have to take note that Jesus wasn't seeking to single out individuals for blame. He was holding up the parable as a reflection of the character of the society that they were living in. And that's vitally important. In other words, the whole state of affairs was being held up for scrutiny. Let's go back to the rich man. He did nothing. He did nothing for a man who was lying outside his very gates. He had enough wealth to wear the finest clothing. He had enough wealth to hold a feast every day. He was not being asked to care for the poor on the other side of the world. But for a man who literally lay against part of his very property. And yet he did nothing. And we have to ask why. And the answer is because Lazarus was nothing to him. In fact, when Lazarus was safely snuggled up in the bosom of Abraham and the rich man was on the other side of the chasm but able to talk, the rich man never even spoke to Lazarus. Why? Because even after death, Lazarus in the rich man's eyes was still untouchable. Perhaps the cherry on top is the fact that not only did the rich man not speak to Lazarus, but he asked Abraham to get Lazarus to dip his finger in cold water for him because his tongue was on fire. So even after death, Lazarus was nothing more to him than a servant or a serf. Lazarus's role is one of passivity. We do not learn much from him except to understand that he was a victim. And if Lazarus was going to have anything in life, he needed help from beyond. The example of the rich man, on the other hand, is a negative one. Having said this, perhaps we do learn something from Lazarus, born out of his silence. The fact that in Lazarus there was no gloating nor vindictiveness towards the rich man. In this parable then, Jesus went beyond what the eye could see, painting a rich tapestry beyond death and inventing dialogue between the father of the nation, Abraham, and the rich man. The point of his teaching wasn't about the nature or the geography of the afterlife. He wasn't seeking to give new insights as to what people of his time believed. What he was giving or doing was giving a new insight into the kind of people to be classed as wicked. In Wright's words, the one who cried, "Blessed are you who are poor, and woe to you who are rich," dramatizes in this story the complete reversal of the overeasy reading of circumstances which labeled the rich blessed and not the poor. And this is seen especially in the men's circumstances after their deaths, where Lazarus the beggar was taken into the arms of Abraham by angels no less, whilst the rich man ended up in Hades in torment. And what we have to realize is the effect that this would have had on those who were listening to Jesus. It would have been a jolt. It would have been a massive jolt for those who often got the short end of the stick and were treated with contempt. Perhaps the jolt would have been a slightly pleasant one. But for those who ridiculed Jesus and wanted to seem out of the way, the Pharisees, who we are also told were lovers of money, the jolt would have been a lot more uncomfortable. For Jesus was chipping away at the very things that gave these men their sense of power and telling them that their way of life was actually corrupt. Furthermore, it seems he was letting them know that they had little time, or perhaps still had time, to mend their ways, unlike the rich man who had left it far too late. And when the rich man, perhaps showing a smidgen of compassion, asked Abraham to send Lazarus to his brothers to warn them to change their ways, the reply from Abraham was simple. They have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them. If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. In a nutshell then, What we have in this parable is the story of a social scene familiar to those who would have heard the words of Jesus, heard him speaking these words, and also familiar beliefs about the afterlife in Jesus' time and what it all looked like. What is shocking about it is the shockingly unfamiliar scenario of a rich man facing the pain of a seemingly irreversible negative judgment on the way that he lived his life. Jesus didn't hector or indict individuals by teaching this, and in fact, he didn't teach it in any direct form or fashion. Instead, he addressed a deeply uncomfortable question to those who were his contemporaries, in the hope that at the very least, it would cause them to think. Our second parable, the one about the rich fool. Fool is such a gritty word. There's no beggar lying at the gates covered in sores. It has no details of sumptuous feasts. In fact, it's a fairly simple tale. And again, the main character did nothing overtly wicked or evil, yet the way he saw his life held a lesson. For this was the kind of man or individual who was responsible for eating up more and more of the land that had been once shared out amongst the population. This was the kind of man or individual who acre by acre destroyed any vision of a promised inheritance for all of Israel. The irony is he lived in a time, much like in many parts of our world today, where great wealth, or any wealth for that matter, was seen as a blessing from God. This means that any negative response towards the rich fool from those who heard the words of Jesus would not have been focused on the man's wealth per se, but rather on the way in which those who were wealthy behaved. For those who were not wealthy, it must be said, would most likely have wanted some of the wealth themselves. In the story we hear about the man's character, not by telling but through showing, for we are privy to the inner thoughts of his mind, which said, if there's too much grain in my barns, why not tear them down and build bigger ones? And then, when that is done, life can be enjoyed and I can make merry. This would not have shocked Jesus' hearers because it sounded like a sensible, reasonable thing to do. What would have shocked them is God's response, "You fool." This is powerful stuff. When Jesus used this term in the Gospel according to Matthew, he used it as a warning that those who followed him were not to use it against other people, and if they did, they would be in danger of the fire of hell. So why did Jesus use the term here? Well, because the term fool was double-edged. In Israelite thinking, a fool was one who denied God's existence. So for example, if the aggressive atheist Richard Dawkins had lived in that time, he would have been considered a fool. In other words, a fool was one who believed that what he had gathered, what he had accumulated in life, was all of his own doing, rather than perhaps a blessing of God. The fool was also one who lacked common sense or wisdom. In this particular parable, the folly of the rich man, where he was lacking in good and common sense, was found in the fact that he completely ignored his own mortality and didn't seem to realize that the wealth that he put his security in could only ever be on a temporary basis. Put another way, the man lived in an illusion, and we are given access to his heart and his mind through the words of Jesus. He may have been stinking rich, but his wealth certainly wasn't an indicator of his wisdom. What Jesus warned against in telling this parable was folly and the kind of thinking that would lead to such folly. Friends, both these parables are lessons for today. for the kind of world we are living in, for the kind of people we are so often encouraged to be. Individuals who think not of others, but simply of themselves. People who gather and gather, believing that what we gather is a reflection of our power, is the marker of our wealth, is the marker of our value. And I could give you umpteen examples of what I mean, of people and of the great injustices we witness in our world, not just in areas of conflict, but everywhere. But that isn't necessary. And it isn't necessary for one simple reason. Because Jesus says, don't put your hope in isms or systems. Don't worship the false idol of self. Don't kid yourself that who you are and what you've managed to obtain is only ever your own doing. Don't fall for the lie that you are an island. Don't think that you're better than anyone because of what you have or what position you hold. Rather, Jesus says, look to me. Rather, trust me and walk with me, because the love you experience with me will transform your heart. My love will change the way you think and act and see the world and all of its people. In me, you will find blessings and abundant life. Not based on wealth or riches or money or power, but based on that which holds the very Godhead together. Based on love. Come, Jesus says, follow me. Amen.